"That I shall not, O beautiful huntress." Then she bowed to Angela, saying, "Train hard, strike first, seer. Blade singer." With a swirl of skirts, she and the teenager strode away, and soon were lost from sight in the maze of identical grey tents.
"What, no marks upon their foreheads?" Aragorn asked Saphira.
"Elva was unique. I shall not brand anyone else in a like manner. What happened in Farthendur just happened. Instinct drove me. Beyond that, I cannot explain."
As the three of them walked toward Nasuada's pavilion, Aragorn glanced at Angela.
"Who were they?"
Her lips quirked.
"Pilgrims on their own quest?" "That is hardly an answer," he complained. "It is not my habit to hand out secrets like candied nuts on winter solstice, especially not when they belong to others."
He was silent for a few paces, then,
"When someone refuses to tell me a certain piece of information, it only makes me that much more determined to find out the truth. I hate being ignorant. For me, a question unanswered is like a thorn in my side that pains me every time I move until I can pluck it out."
"You have my sympathy. Why is that?"
"Because if that is so, you must spend every waking hour in mortal agony, for life is full of unanswerable questions."
60 feet from Nasuada's pavilion, a contingent of pikemen marching through camp blocked their way. While they waited for the warriors to file past, Aragorn shivered and blew on his hands.
"I wish we had time for a meal."
Quick as ever, Angela said,
"It's the magic, isn't it? It has worn you down."
He nodded, sticking a hand into one of the pouches that hung from her sash. Angela pulled out a hard brown lump, flecked with shiny flax seeds.
"Here, this will hold you until lunch."
"What is it?" She thrust it at him, insistent.
"Eat it. You'll like it, trust me."
As he took the oily lump from between her fingers, she grasped his wrist with her other hand and held him in place while she inspected the half-inch-high calluses on his knuckles.
"How very clever of you," she said. "They are as ugly as the warts on a toad, but who cares if they help keep your skin intact, eh? I like this. I like this quite a lot. Were you inspired by the dwarves Asgard-Gameln?"
"Nothing escapes you, does it?" he asked.
"Let it escape. I only concern myself with things that exist."
Aragorn blinked, thrown as he often was by her verbal trickery. She tapped a callus with the tip of one of her short fingernails.
"I would do this myself, except that it would catch on the wool when I'm spinning or knitting."
"You knit with your own yarn?" he said, surprised that she would engage in anything so ordinary.
"Of course. It's a wonderful way to relax. Besides, if I didn't, where would I get a sweater with Dvalar's ward against mad rabbits knit in the Lidwyn Cavadi across the inside of the chest? Or a snood that was dyed yellow, green, and bright pink? Mad rabbits?"
She tossed her thick curls.
"You would be amazed how many magicians have died after being bitten by mad rabbits. It's far more common than you might think."
Aragorn stared at her.
"Do you think she's jesting?" he asked Saphira.
"Ask her and find out."
"She would only answer with another riddle."
The pikemen having gone, Aragorn, Saphira, and Angela continued toward the pavilion, accompanied by Solemnbum, who had joined them without Aragorn noticing. Picking her way around piles of dung left by the horses of King Orin's cavalry, Angela said,
"So tell me, aside from your fight with the Razak, did anything terribly interesting happen to you during your trip? You know how I love to hear about interesting things."
Aragorn smiled, thinking of the spirits that had visited him and Arya. However, he did not want to discuss them, so instead he said,
"Since you ask, quite a few interesting things happened. For example, I met a hermit named Tengah, living in the ruins of an elf tower. He possessed the most amazing library. In it were seven...
Angela stopped so abruptly. Aragorn kept walking another 3 paces before he caught himself and turned back. The witch seemed stunned, as if she had taken a hard knock to her head. Padding toward her, Solombum leaned against her legs and gazed upward. Angela wet her lips, then said,
"Are?" She coughed once. "Are you sure? His name was Tenga. Have you met him?"
Solombum hissed, and the hair on his back stood straight out. Aragorn edged away from the weercat, eager to escape the reach of his claws.
"Met him?"
With a bitter laugh, Angela planted her hands on her hips.
"Met him? Why, I did better than that. I was his apprentice for an unfortunate number of years."
Aragorn had never expected Angela to willingly reveal anything about her past. Eager to learn more, he asked,
"When did you meet him? And where?"
"Long ago and far away. However, we parted badly, and I have not seen him for many, many years." Angela frowned. "In fact, I thought he was already dead." Saphira spoke then, saying,
"Since you were Tenga's apprentice, do you know what question he's trying to answer?"
"I have not the slightest idea. Tenga always had a question he was trying to answer. If he succeeded, he immediately chose another one, and so on. He may have answered 100 questions since I last saw him, or he may still be gnashing his teeth over the same conundrum as when I left him. Which was? Whether the phases of the moon influenced the number and quality of the opals that form in the roots of the Beor Mountains, as is commonly held among the dwarves."
"But how could you prove that?" objected Aragorn.
Angela shrugged.
"If anyone could, it would be Tenga. He may be deranged, but his brilliance is nonetheless for it."
"He is a man who kicks at cats," said Solombum,
as if that summed up Tenga's entire character. Then Angela clapped her hands together and said,
"No more. Eat your sweet, Aragorn, and let us go to Nasawada."
Making Amends.
"You are late,"
said Nasawada, as Aragorn and Angela found seats in the row of chairs arranged in a semicircle before Nasawada's high-backed throne. Also seated in the semicircle were Elva and her caretaker Greta, the old woman who had pleaded with Aragorn in Farthendur to bless her charge. As before, Saphira lay outside the pavilion and stuck her head through an opening at one end so that she could participate in the meeting. Solombum had curled up in a ball next to her head. He appeared to be sound asleep, except for occasional flicks of his tail. Along with Angela, Aragorn made his apologies for their tardiness, and then he listened as Nasawada explained to Elva the value of her abilities to the Varden.
"As if she doesn't already know," Aragorn commented to Saphira,
and entreated her to release Aragorn from his promise to try to undo the effects of his blessing. She said she understood that what she was asking of Elva was difficult, but the fate of the entire land was at stake, and was it not worth sacrificing one's own comfort to help rescue Alagazia from Galbatorix's evil clutches? It was a magnificent speech, eloquent, impassioned, and full of arguments intended to appeal to Elva's more noble sentiments. Elva, who had been resting her small, pointed chin on her fists, raised her head and said,
"No."
Shocked silence pervaded the pavilion. Transferring her unblinking gaze from one person to the next, she elaborated,
"Aragorn, Angela, you both know what it is like to share someone's thoughts and emotions as they die. You know how horrible, how wrenching it is, how it feels as if part of yourself has vanished forever. And that is only from the death of one person. Neither of you has to endure the experience unless you want to, whereas I I have no choice but to share them all. I feel every death around me. Even now I can feel the life ebbing out of Sefton, one of your swordsmen, Nasuada, who was wounded on the burning plains. And I know what words I could say to him that would lessen his terror of obliteration. His fear is so great, oh, it makes me tremble!
With an incoherent cry, she cast up her arms before her face, as if to ward off a blow. Then,
ah, he has gone. But there are others. There are always others. The line of dead never ends.
The bitter, mocking quality of her voice intensified, a travesty of a child's normal speech.
Do you truly understand, Nasuada, Lady Nightstalker, she who would be queen of the world? Do you truly understand? I am privy to all of the agony around me, whether physical or mental. I feel it as if it were my own, and Aragorn's magic drives me to alleviate the discomfort of those who suffer, regardless of the cost to myself. And if I resist the urge as I am this very moment, my body rebels against me. My stomach turns acid, my head throbs as if a dwarf is hammering on it, and I find it hard to move, much less think. Is this what you would wish on me, Nasuada? Night and day I have no respite from the pain of the world. Since Aragorn blessed me, I have known nothing but hurt and fear, never happiness or pleasure. The lighter side of life, the things that make this existence bearable, these are denied me. Never do I see them, never do I share in them. Only darkness, only the combined misery of all the men, women and children within a mile battering at me like a midnight storm. This blessing has deprived me of the opportunity to be like other children. It has forced my body to mature faster than normal, and my mind even faster still. Aragorn may be able to remove this ghastly ability of mine, and the compulsion that accompanies it. But he cannot return me to what I was, nor what I should be, not without destroying who I have become. I am a freak, neither a child nor an adult, forever doomed to stand apart. I am not blind, you know. I see how you recoil when you hear me speak.
She shook her head.
No, this is too much to ask of me. I will not continue like this for the sake of you, Nasuada, nor the Varden, nor the whole of Alagazia, nor even for my dear mother, were she still alive today. It is not worth it, not for anything. I could go live by myself so that I would be free of other people's afflictions, but I do not want to live like that.
No, the only solution is for Aragorn to attempt to correct his mistake. Her lips curved in a sly smile. And if you disagree with me, if you think I am being stupid and selfish, why then you would do well to remember that I am hardly more than a swaddling babe, and have yet to celebrate my second birthday. Only fools expect an infant to martyr herself for the greater good. But infant or not, I have made my decision, and nothing you can say will convince me otherwise. In this, I am as iron.
Nasuada reasoned with her further, but, as Elva had promised, it proved to be a futile prospect. At last Nasuada asked Angela, Aragorn, and Saphira to intervene. Angela refused on the grounds that she could not improve on Nasuada's words, and that she believed Elva's choice was a personal one, and therefore the girl ought to be able to do as she wished, without being harried like an eagle by a flock of jays. Aragorn was of a similar opinion, but he consented to say,
"Elva,
I cannot tell you what you should do. Only you can determine that. But do not reject Nasuada's request out of hand. She is trying to save us all from Galbatorix, and she needs our support if we are to have any chance of success. The future is hidden to me, but I believe that your ability might be the perfect weapon against Galbatorix. You could predict his every attack. You could tell us exactly how to counteract his wars. And above all else, you would be able to sense where Galbatorix is vulnerable, where he is most weak, and what we could do to hurt him.
You will have to do better than that, Ryder, if you want to change my mind.
I don't want to change your mind, said Aragorn. I only want to make sure you have given due consideration to the implications of your decision, and that you are not being overly hasty.
The girl shifted, but did not respond. Then Saphira asked,
What is in your heart, O Shining Brow?
Elva answered in a soft tone, with no trace of malice.
I have spoken my heart, Saphira. Any other words would be redundant.
If Nasuada was frustrated by Elva's obstinacy, she did not allow it to show, although her expression was stern, as befitted the discussion. She said,
I do not agree with your choice, Elva, but we will abide by it, for it is obvious that we cannot sway you. I suppose I cannot fault you, as I have no experience with the suffering you are exposed to on a daily basis. And if I were in your position, it is possible I would act no differently. Aragorn, if you will.
At her bidding, Aragorn knelt in front of Elva. Her lustrous violet eyes bored into him as he placed her small hands between his larger ones. Her flesh burned against his as if she had a fever.
Will it hurt, Shadeslayer?
Greta asked, the old woman's voice quavering.
It shouldn't, but I do not know for sure. Removing spells is a much more inexact art than casting them. Magicians rarely, if ever, attempt it because of the challenges it poses.
The wrinkles on her face contorted with worry. Greta patted Elva on the head, saying,
Oh, be brave, my plum, be brave.
She did not seem to notice the look of irritation Elva directed at her. Aragorn ignored the interruption.
Elva, listen to me. There are two different methods for breaking an enchantment. One is for the magician who originally cast the spell to open himself to the energy that fuels our magic. That's the part I always had difficulty with, said Angela. It's why I rely more on potions and plants and objects that are magical in and of themselves than upon incantations. If you don't mind,
her cheeks dimpling, Angela said,
I'm sorry. Proceed.
Right, growled Aragorn. One is for the original magician to open himself.
Or herself,
Angela interjected.
Will you please let me finish? Sorry.
Aragorn saw Nasuada fight back a smile.
He opens himself to the flow of energy within his body, and speaking in the ancient language recants not only the words of his spell, but also the intention behind it. This can be quite difficult, as you might imagine. Unless the magician has the right intent, he will end up altering the original spell instead of lifting it, and then he would have to unsay two intertwined spells. The other method is to cast a spell that directly counteracts the effects of the original spell. It does not eliminate the original spell, but if done properly, it renders it harmless. With your permission, this is the method I intend to use.
A most elegant solution, Angela proclaimed. But who, pray tell, provides the continuous stream of energy needed to maintain this counterspell? And since someone must ask, what can go wrong with this particular method?
Aragorn kept his gaze fixed on Elva.
The energy will have to come from you, he told her, pressing her hands with his. It won't be much, but it will still reduce your stamina by a certain amount. If I do this, you will never be able to run as far or lift as many pieces of firewood as someone who does not have a similar incantation leeching off them.
Why can't you provide the energy? Asked Elver, arching an eyebrow. You are the one who is responsible for my predicament, after all.
I would, but the farther away I got from you, the harder it would be to send the energy to you. And if I went too far, a mile, say, or maybe a bit more, the effort would kill me. As for what can go wrong, the only risk is that I will word the counterspell improperly and it won't block all of my blessing. If that happens, I will simply cast another counterspell.
And if that falls short as well?
He paused. Then I can always resort to the first method I explained. I would prefer to avoid that, however. It is the only way to completely do away with a spell, but if the attempt were to go amiss, and it very well might, you could end up worse off than you are now.
Elver nodded. I understand.
Have I your permission to proceed, then?
When she dipped her chin again, Eragon took a deep breath, readying himself. His eyes half closed from the strength of his concentration. He began to speak in the ancient language. Each word fell from his tongue with the weight of a hammer blow. He was careful to enunciate every syllable, every sound that was foreign to his own language, so as to avoid a potentially tragic mishap. The counterspell was burned into his memory. He had spent many hours during his trip from Hellgrind inventing it, agonizing over it, challenging himself to devise better alternatives, all in anticipation of the day he would attempt to atone for the harm he had caused Elver. As he spoke, Saphira channeled her strength into him, and he felt her supporting him and watching closely, ready to intervene if she saw in his mind that he was about to mangle the incantation. The counterspell was very long and very complicated, for he had sought to address every reasonable interpretation of his blessing. As a result, a full 5 minutes passed before Eragon uttered the last sentence, word, and then syllable. In the silence that followed, Elva's face clouded with disappointment.
I can still sense them, she said.
Nasuada leaned forward in her seat.
Who?
You, him, her, everyone who's in pain, they haven't gone away. The urge to help them, that's gone. But this agony still courses through me.
Nasuada leaned forward in her throne.
Eragon?
He frowned.
I must have missed something. Give me a little while to think, and I'll put together another spell that may do the trick. There are a few other possibilities I considered, but...
He trailed off, troubled by the fact that the counterspell had not performed as expected. Moreover, deploying a spell specifically to block the pain Elva was feeling would be far more difficult than trying to undo the blessing as a whole. One wrong word, one poorly constructed phrase, and he might destroy her sense of empathy, or preclude her from ever learning how to communicate with her mind, or inhibit her own sense of pain, so she would not immediately notice when she was injured. Eragon was in the midst of consulting with Saphira, when Elva said,
No.
Puzzled, he looked at her.
An ecstatic glow seemed to emanate from Elva. Her round, pearl-like teeth gleamed as she smiled, her eyes flashing with triumphant joy.
No! Don't try again!
But Elver, why would...
Because I don't want any more spells feeding off me.
And because I just realized I can ignore them.
She gripped the arms of her chair, trembling with excitement.
Without the urge to aid everyone who is suffering, I can ignore their troubles and it doesn't make me sick. I can ignore the man with the amputated leg. I can ignore the woman who just scalded her hand. I can ignore them all. And I feel no worse for it. It's true, I can't block them perfectly, not yet at least. But oh, what a relief! Silence! Blessed silence! No more cuts, scrapes, bruises, or broken bones. No more petty worries of air-headed youths. No more anguish of abandoned wives or cuckolded husbands. No more the thousands of unbearable injuries of an entire war. No more the gut-wrenching panic that precedes the final darkness. With tears starting down her cheeks, she laughed, a husky warble that set Aragorn's scalp a-tingle.
"What madness is this?"
asked Saphira.
"Even if you can put it out of your mind, why remain shackled to the pain of others, when Aragorn may yet be able to free you of it?"
Elva's eyes glowed with unsavory glee.
"I will never be like ordinary people. If I must be different, then let me keep that which sets me apart. As long as I can control this power, as it seems I now can, I have no objection to carrying this burden, for it shall be by my choice, and not forced upon me by your magic, Aragorn. Ha! From now on I shall answer to no one and no thing. If I help anyone, it will be because I want to. If I serve the Varden, it will be because my conscience tells me I should, and not because you ask me to, Nasawada, or because I'll throw up if I don't. I will do as I please, and woe unto those who oppose me, for I know all their fears, and shall not hesitate to play upon them, in order to fulfill my wishes."
"Elva," exclaimed Greta, "do not say such terrible things. You cannot mean them."
The girl turned toward her so sharply her hair fanned out behind her.
"Ah, yes, I had forgotten about you, my nursemaid. Ever faithful, always fussing. I am grateful to you for adopting me after my mother died, and for the care you've given me since Farthendur. But I do not require your assistance any more. I will live alone, tend to myself, and be beholden to no one."
Cowed, the old woman covered her mouth with the hem of her sleeve, and shrank back. What Elva said appalled Aragorn. He decided that he could not allow her to retain her ability if she was going to abuse it. With Saphira's assistance, for she agreed with him, he picked the most promising of the new counterspells he had been contemplating earlier, and opened his mouth to deliver the lines. Quick as a snake, Elva clamped a hand over his lips, preventing him from speaking. The pavilion shook as Saphira snarled, nearly deafening Aragorn with his enhanced hearing. As everyone reeled, save for Elva, who kept her hand pressed against Aragorn's face, Saphira said,
"Let him go, hatchling!"
Drawn by Saphira's snarl, Nasawada's six guards charged inside, brandishing their weapons, while Blodgarm and the other elves ran up to Saphira and stationed themselves on either side of her shoulders, pulling back the wall of the tent so they could all see what was happening. Nasawada gestured, and the Nighthawks lowered their weapons. But the elves remained poised for action. Their blades gleamed like ice. Neither the commotion she had engendered nor the swords leveled at her seemed to perturb Elva. She cocked her head and gazed at Aragorn as if he were an unusual beetle she had found crawling along the edge of her chair. And then she smiled with such a sweet, innocent expression, he wondered why he did not have greater faith in her character. In a voice like warm honey, she said,
"Aragorn, cease. If you cast that spell, you will hurt me as you hurt me once before. You do not want that. Every night when you lay yourself down to sleep, you will think of me, and the memory of the wrong you have committed will torment you. What you were about to do was evil, Aragorn. Are you the judge of the world? Will you condemn me in the absence of wrongdoing, merely because you do not approve of me? That way lies the depraved pleasure of controlling others for your own satisfaction. Galbatorix would approve. She released him then, but Aragorn was too troubled to move. She had struck at his very core, and he had no counter-arguments with which to defend himself, for her questions and observations were the very ones he directed at himself. Her understanding of him sent a chill crawling down his spine. "I am grateful to you also, Aragorn, for coming here today to correct your mistake. Not everyone is as willing to acknowledge and confront their shortcomings. However, you have earned no favor with me today. You have righted the scales as best you could, but that is only what any decent person ought to have done. You have not compensated me for what I have endured, nor can you. So when next we cross paths, Aragorn, Shadeslayer, count me not as a friend or foe. I am ambivalent toward you, Rider. I am just as prepared to hate you as I am to love you. The outcome is yours alone to decide. Saphira, you gave me the star upon my brow, and you have always been kind to me. I am, and shall always remain, your faithful servant." Lifting her chin to maximize her 3.5-foot height, Elva surveyed the interior of the pavilion. "Aragorn, Saphira, Nasawada, Angela, good day." And with that she swept off toward the entrance. The Nighthawks parted ranks as she passed between them and went outside. Aragorn stood, feeling unsteady. "What sort of monster have I created?" The two Urgal Nighthawks touched the tip of each of their horns, which he knew was how they warded off evil. To Nasawada he said, "I'm sorry. I seem to have only made things worse for you, for all of us." Calm as a mountain lake, Nasawada arranged her robes before answering, "No matter. The game has gotten a little more complicated, that is all. It is to be expected, the closer we get to Urubain and Galbatorix." A moment later, Aragorn heard the sound of an object rushing through the air toward him. He flinched, but fast as he was too slow to avoid a stinging slap that knocked his head to one side and sent him staggering against a chair. He rolled across the seat of the chair and sprang upright, his left arm lifted to ward off an oncoming blow, his right arm pulled back, ready to stab with the hunting knife he had snatched from his belt during the maneuver. To his astonishment, he saw that it was Angela who had struck him. The elves were gathered inches behind the fortune-teller, ready to subdue her if she should attack him again, or to escort her away should Aragorn order it. Solemnbum was at her feet, teeth and claws bared, and his hair standing on end. Right then Aragorn could care less about the elves. "What did you do that for?" he demanded. He winced as his split lower lip stretched, tearing the flesh farther apart. Warm, metallic-tasting blood trickled down his throat. Angela tossed her head. "Now I'm going to have to spend the next 10 years teaching Elva how to behave. That's not what I had in mind for the next decade." "Teach her?" exclaimed Aragorn. "She won't let you. She'll stop you as easily as she stopped me." "Humph, not likely. She doesn't know what bothers me, nor what might be about to hurt me. I saw to that the day she and I first met." "Would you share this spell with us?" Nasawada asked. "After how this has turned out, it seems prudent for us to have a means of protecting ourselves from Elva." "No, I don't think I will," said Angela. Then she too marched out of the pavilion, and Solemnbum stalked after her, waving his tail ever so gracefully. The elves sheathed their blades and retreated to a discreet distance from the tent. Nasawada rubbed her temples with a circular motion.
"Magic,"
she cursed. "Magic," agreed Aragorn. The pair of them started, as Greta cast herself upon the ground and began to weep and wail, while pulling at her thin hair, beating herself on the face, and ripping at her bodice.
"Oh, my poor dear, I've lost my lamb,"
Lost! What will become of her all alone? Oh, woe is me, my own little blossom rejecting me. It's a shameful reward it is for the work I've done, bending my back like a slave I have. What a cruel, hard world, always stealing your happiness from you. She groaned. My plum, my rose, my pretty sweet pea, gone, and no one to look after her. Shadeslayer, will you watch over her?
Aragorn grasped her by the arm and helped her to her feet, consoling her with assurances that he and Saphira would keep a close eye on Elva.
If only,
as Saphira said to Aragorn,
because she might attempt to slip a knife between our ribs.
Gifts of Gold. Aragorn stood next to Saphira, 50 yards from Nasuada's crimson pavilion, glad to be free of all the commotion that had surrounded Elva. He gazed up at the clear azure sky and rolled his shoulders, already tired from the events of the day. Saphira intended to fly out to the Jeet River and bathe herself in its deep, slow-moving water, but his own intentions were less definite. He still needed to finish oiling his armor, prepare for Roran and Katrina's wedding, visit with Jod, locate a proper sword for himself, and also... He scratched his chin.
How long will you be gone?
He asked. Saphira unfurled her wings in preparation for flight.
A few hours. I'm hungry. Once I am clean, I am going to catch 2 or 3 of those plump deer I've seen nibbling the grass on the western bank of the river. The Varden have shot so many of them, though, I may have to fly 6 leagues toward the spine before I find any game worth hunting.
Don't go too far, he cautioned, else you might encounter the Empire.
I won't, but if I happen upon a lone group of soldiers...
She licked her chops.
I would enjoy a quick fight. Besides, humans taste just as good as deer.
Saphira, you wouldn't!
Her eyes sparkled.
Maybe. Maybe not. It depends on whether they are wearing armor. I hate biting through metal, and scooping my food out of a shell is just as annoying.
I see. He glanced over at the nearest elf, a tall, silver-haired woman.
The elves won't want you to go alone. Will you allow a couple of them to ride on you? Otherwise it will be impossible for them to keep pace.
Not today. Today I hunt alone.
With a sweep of her wings, she took off, soaring high overhead. As she turned west toward the Jeet River, her voice sounded in his mind, fainter than before because of the distance between them.
When I return, we will fly together, won't we, Aragorn?
Yes, when you return we will fly together, just the two of us.
Her pleasure at that caused him to smile as he watched her arrow away toward the west. Aragorn lowered his gaze as Blodgarm ran up to him, lithe as a forest cat. The elf asked where Saphira was going, and seemed displeased with Aragorn's explanation, but if he had any objections, he kept them to himself.
Right.
Aragorn said to himself as Blodgarm rejoined his companions.
First things first.
He strode through the camp until he found a large square of open space, where 30-some Varden were practicing with a wide assortment of weapons. To his relief, they were too busy training to notice his presence. Crouching, he lay his right hand palm upward on the trampled earth. He chose the words he would need from the ancient language, then murmured,
Kuldr, Raisa Lam iet un Malthene unen Boller.
The soil beside his hand appeared unchanged, although he could feel the spell sifting through the dirt for hundreds of feet in every direction. Not more than 5 seconds later, The surface of the earth began to boil, like a pot of water left to sit for too long over a high flame, and it acquired a bright yellow sheen. Aragorn had learned from Oromis that wherever one went, the land was sure to contain minute particles of nearly every element, and while they would be too small and scattered to mine with traditional methods, a knowledgeable magician could, with great effort, extract them. From the center of the yellow patch, a fountain of sparkling dust arched up and over, landing in the middle of Aragorn's palm. There, each glittering mote melded into the next until three spheres of pure gold, each the size of a large hazelnut, rested on his hand.
"Letter," said Aragorn, and released the magic.
He sat back on his heels and braced himself against the ground as a wave of weariness washed over him. His head drooped forward and his eyelids descended halfway as his vision flickered and dimmed. Taking a deep breath, he admired the mirror-smooth orbs in his hand while he waited for his strength to return.
"So pretty," he thought. "If only I could have done this when we were living in Palancar Valley.
It would almost be easier to mine the gold, though. A spell hasn't taken so much out of me since I carried Sloane down from the top of Hellgrind." He pocketed the gold and set out again through the camp. He found a cook tent and ate a large lunch which he needed after casting so many arduous spells, then headed toward the area where the villagers from Carverhall were staying. As he approached, he heard the ring of metal striking metal. Curious, he turned in that direction. Aragorn stepped around a line of three wagons parked across the mouth of the lane, and saw Horst standing in a 30-foot gap between the tents, holding one end of a 5-foot-long bar of steel. The other end of the bar was bright cherry red, and rested on the face of a massive 200-pound anvil that was staked to the top of a low, wide stump. On either side of the anvil, Horst's burly sons, Albrecht and Baldur, alternated striking the steel with sledgehammers, which they swung over their heads in huge circular blows. A makeshift forge glowed several feet behind the anvil. The hammering was so loud Aragorn kept his distance, until Albrecht and Baldur had finished spreading the steel, and Horst had returned the bar to the forge. Waving his free arm, Horst said, "Ho, Aragorn!" Then he held up a finger, forestalling Aragorn's reply, and pulled a plug of felted wool out of his left ear.
"Ah, now I can hear again. What brings you about, Aragorn?"
While he spoke, his sons scooped more charcoal into the forge from a bucket, and set about tidying up the tongs, hammers, dies, and other tools that lay on the ground. All three men gleamed with sweat.
"I wanted to know what was causing such a commotion," said Aragorn. "I should have guessed it was you. No one else can create as big an uproar as someone from Carverhall."
Horst laughed. His thick, spade-shaped beard pointed up toward the sky until his mirth was exhausted.
"Ha ha ha! That tickles my pride, it does. And aren't you the living truth of it, eh?"
"We all are," Aragorn replied. "You, me, Roran, everyone from Carverhall. Alagazia will never be the same once the lot of us are done." He gestured at the forge and the other equipment.
"Why are you here? I thought that all the smiths were—"
"So they are, Aragorn, so they are. However, I convinced the captain who's in charge of this part of the camp to let me work closer to our tent."
Horst tugged at the end of his beard.
"It's on account of Elaine, you know. This child, it goes hard with her, and no wonder, considering what we went through to get here. She's always been delicate, and now I worry that, well," he shook himself like a bear ridding itself of flies, "maybe you could look in on her when you get a chance and see if you can ease her discomfort."
"I'll do that," Aragorn promised. With a satisfied grunt, Horse lifted the bar partway out of the coals, to better judge the color of the steel. Plunging the bar back into the center of the fire, he jerked his beard toward Albrecht.
"Here now, give it some air. It's almost ready."
As Albrecht began to pump the leather bellows, Horst grinned at Aragorn.
When I told the Varden I was a smith, they were so happy you would have thought I was another dragon rider. They don't have enough metal workers, you see, and they gave me what tools I was missing, including that anvil. When we left Carverhall, I wept at the prospect that I would not have the opportunity to practice my craft again. I am no swordsmith, but here, ah, here there is enough work to keep Albrecht, Baldur and me busy for the next 50 years. It doesn't pay very well, but at least we're not stretched out on a rack in Galbatorix's dungeons.
Or the Razak could be nibbling on our bones, observed Baldur.
Aye, that too.
Horst motioned for his sons to take up the sledgehammers again, and then, holding the felt plug beside his left ear, said,
Is there anything else you wish of us, Aragorn? The steel is ready, and I cannot leave it in the fire any longer without weakening it.
Do you know where Gedric is?
Gedric?
The furrow between Horst's eyebrows deepened.
He should be practicing the sword and spear along with the rest of the men. That-a-way, about a quarter of a mile.
Horst pointed with a thumb. Aragorn thanked him, and departed in the direction Horst had indicated. The repetitive ring of metal striking metal resumed, clear as the peals of a bell and as sharp and piercing as a glass needle stabbing the air. Aragorn covered his ears and smiled. It comforted him that Horst had retained his strength of purpose, and that despite the loss of his wealth and home, he was still the same person he had been in Carverhall. Somehow the smith's consistency and resiliency renewed Aragorn's faith that if only they could overthrow Galbatorix, everything would be all right in the end, and his life and those of the villagers from Carverhall would regain a semblance of normalcy. Aragorn soon arrived at the field where the men of Carverhall were drilling with their new weapons. Gedric was there, as Horst had suggested he would be, sparring with Fisk, Darman, and Morn. A quick word on the part of Aragorn with the one-armed veteran who was leading the drills was sufficient to secure Gedric's temporary release. The tanner ran over to Aragorn and stood before him, his gaze lowered. He was short and swarthy, with a jaw like a mastiff's, heavy eyebrows, and arms thick and gnarled, from stirring the foul-smelling vats where he had cured his hides. Although he was far from handsome, Aragorn knew him to be a kind and honest man.
"What can I do for you, Shadeslayer?"
Gedric mumbled.
"You have already done it, and I have come here to thank and repay you."
"I? How have I helped you, Shadeslayer?"
He spoke slowly, cautiously, as if afraid Aragorn was setting a trap for him.
Soon after I ran away from Carverhall, you discovered that someone had stolen 3 oxhides from the drying hut by the vats. Am I right?
Gedric's face darkened with embarrassment, and he shuffled his feet.
Ah, well, now, I didn't lock that hut, you know. Anyone might have snuck in and carried those hides off. Besides, given what's happened since, I can't see as it's much important. I destroyed most of my stock before we trooped into the Spine to keep the Empire and those filthy Razak from getting their claws on anything of use. Whoever took those hides saved me from having to destroy 3 more. So let bygones be bygones, I say.
Perhaps, said Aragorn, but I still feel honour-bound to tell you that it was I who stole your hides.
Gedric met his gaze then, looking at him as if he were an ordinary person, without fear, awe, or undue respect, as if the tanner were re-evaluating his opinion of Aragorn.
I stole them, and I'm not proud of it, but I needed the hides. Without them, I doubt I would have survived long enough to reach the elves in Duweldenvarden. I always preferred to think that I had borrowed the hides, but the truth is, I stole them, for I had no intention of returning them. Therefore, you have my apologies. And since I am keeping the hides, or what is left of them, it seems only right to pay you for them.
From within his belt, Aragorn removed one of the spheres of gold, hard, round, and warm from the heat of his flesh, and handed it to Gedric. Gedrick stared at the shiny metal pearl, his massive jaw clamped shut, the lines around his thin-lipped mouth harsh and unyielding. He did not insult Aragon by weighing the gold in his hand, nor by biting it. But when he spoke, he said,
"I cannot accept this, Aragon. I was a good tanner, but the leather I made was not worth this much. Your generosity does you credit, but it would bother me to keep this gold. I would feel as if I hadn't earned it."
Unsurprised, Aragon said, "You would not deny another man the opportunity to haggle for a fair price, would you?"
"No."
"Good. Then you cannot deny me this. Most people haggle downward. In this case, I have chosen to haggle upward. But I will still haggle as fiercely as if I were trying to save myself a handful of coins. To me, the hides are worth every ounce of that gold, and I would not pay you a copper less, not even if you held a knife to my throat."
Gedrick's thick fingers closed around the gold orb. "Since you insist, I will not be so churlish as to keep refusing you. No one can say that Gedrick Ostfensen allowed good fortune to pass him by because he was too busy protesting his own unworthiness. My thanks, Shadeslayer."
He placed the orb in a pouch on his belt, wrapping the gold in a patch of wool cloth to protect it from scratches.
"Garrow did right by you, Aragon. He did right by both you and Roran. He may have been sharp as vinegar and as hard and dry as a winter rutabaga, but he raised the two of you well. He would be proud of you, I think."
Unexpected emotion clogged Aragon's chest. As Gedrick turned to rejoin the other villagers, he paused.
"If I may ask, Aragon, why were those hides worth so much to you? What did you use them for?"
Aragon chuckled.
"Use them for? Why, with Brom's help, I made a saddle for Saphira out of them. She doesn't wear it as often as she used to, not since the elves gave us a proper dragon saddle. But it served us well through many a scrape and fight, and even the Battle of Farthendur."
Astonishment raised Gedrick's eyebrows, exposing pale skin that normally lay hidden in deep folds. Like a split in blue-grey granite, a wide grin spread across his jaw, transforming his features.
"A saddle," he breathed. "Imagine me tanning the leather for a rider's saddle, and without a hint of what I was doing at the time, no less. No, not a rider. The rider. He who will finally cast down the black tyrant himself. If only my father could see me now."
Kicking up his heels, Gedrick danced an impromptu jig. With his grin undiminished, he bowed to Aragon and trotted back to his place among the villagers, where he began to relate his tale to everyone within earshot. Eager to escape before the lot of them could descend upon him, Aragon slipped away between the rows of tents, pleased with what he had accomplished.
"It might take me a while," he thought, "but I always settle my debts."
Before long, he arrived at another tent, close to the eastern edge of the camp. He knocked on the pole between the two front flaps. With a sharp sound, the entrance was yanked aside to reveal Jode's wife, Helen, standing in the opening. She regarded Aragon with a cold expression.
"You've come to talk with him, I suppose? If he's here."
Which Aragon knew perfectly well he was, for he could sense Jode's mind as clearly as Helen's. For a moment Aragon thought Helen might deny the presence of her husband, but then she shrugged and moved aside.
"You might as well come in, then."
Aragon found Jode sitting on a stool, poring over an assortment of scrolls, books and sheaves of loose papers that were piled high on a cot bare of blankets. A thin shock of hair hung across Jode's forehead, mimicking the curve of the scar that stretched from his scalp to his left temple.
"Aragon!"
he cried as he saw him, the lines of concentration on his face clearing.
"Welcome, welcome!"
He shook Aragon's hand and then offered him the stool.
"Here, I shall sit on the corner of the bed. No, please. You are our guest.
Would you care for some food or drink? Nasawada gives us an extra ration, so do not restrain yourself for fear that we will go hungry on your account. It is poor fare compared with what we served you in Tirm, but then no one should go to war and expect to eat well, not even a king. A cup of tea would be nice, said Aragorn. Tea and biscuits it is.
Jode glanced at Helen. Snatching the kettle off the ground, Helen braced it against her hip, fit the nipple of a water skin in the end of the spout, and squeezed. The kettle reverberated with a dull roar as a stream of water struck the bottom. Helen's fingers tightened around the neck of the water skin, restricting the flow to a languorous trickle. She remained thus, with the detached look of a person performing an unpleasant task, while the water droplets drummed out a maddening beat against the inside of the kettle. An apologetic smile flickered across Jode's face. He stared at a scrap of paper beside his knee as he waited for Helen to finish. Aragorn studied a wrinkle in the side of the tent. The bombastic trickle continued for over 3 minutes. When the kettle was finally full, Helen removed the deflated waterskin from the spout, hung it on a hook on the center pole of the tent, and stormed out. Aragorn raised an eyebrow at Jode. Jode spread his hands.
My position with the Varden is not as prominent as she had hoped, and she blames me for the fact. She agreed to flee Tirm with me expecting, or so I believe, that Nasawada would vault me into the inner circle of her advisers, or grant me lands and riches fit for a lord or some other extravagant reward for my help stealing Saphira's egg those many years ago. What Helen did not bargain on was the unglamorous life of a common swordsman, sleeping in a tent, fixing her own food, washing her own clothes, and so on. It's not that wealth and status are her only concerns, but you have to understand. She was born into one of the richest shipping families of Tirm, and for most of our marriage I was not unsuccessful in my own ventures. She is unused to such privations as these, and she has yet to reconcile herself to them.
His shoulders rose and fell a fraction of an inch.
My own hope was that this adventure, if it deserves such a romantic term, would narrow the rifts that have opened between us in recent years. But, as always, nothing is ever as simple as it seems. Do you feel that the Varden ought to show you greater consideration? Asked Aragorn. For myself, no. For Helen?
Jode hesitated.
I want her to be happy. My reward was in escaping from Gilead with my life when Brom and I were attacked by Morzan, his dragon, and his men, in the satisfaction of knowing that I had helped strike a crippling blow against Galbatorix, in being able to return to my previous life and yet still help further the Varden's cause, and in being able to marry Helen. Those were my rewards, and I am more than content with them. Any doubts I had vanished the instant I saw Saphira fly out of the smoke of the burning plains. I do not know what to do about Helen, though. But I forget myself. These are not your troubles, and I should not lay them upon you.
Aragorn touched a scroll with the tip of his index finger.
Then tell me, why so many papers? Have you become a copyist?
The question amused Jode.
Hardly, although the work is often as tedious. Since it was I who discovered the hidden passageway into Galbatorix's castle in Urabane, and I was able to bring with me some of the rare books from my library in Tirm, Nasawada has set me to searching for similar weaknesses in the other cities of the Empire. If I could find mention of a tunnel that led underneath the walls of Drasleona, for example, it might save us a great deal of bloodshed. Where are you looking? Everywhere I can.
Jode brushed back the lock of hair that was hanging over his forehead.
Histories, myths, legends, poems, songs, religious tracts, the writings of riders, magicians, wanderers, madmen, obscure potentates, various generals, anyone who might have knowledge of a hidden door or a secret mechanism or something of that ilk that we might turn to our advantage.